Every time we have intellectually interfered with a 15 billion year process in preparation, that intellectual interference has been paid for at a bitter price. And we never learn. Intellect never learns that. And also we make money off of it. So immediately anything goes. At any rate, birth itself is, of course, a mammalian process. We know, and this is not just a joke, we know this is handled through the mammalian brain structure. And we know we've inherited that from millions of years of genetic encoding. And that mammalian, we call these mammary glands, those marvelous protuberances, mammary glands for good reason. They're mammalian. They're inherited from our mammalian ancestors. Paul MacLean did some of his most brilliant work on how, in order to build great new unprogrammed, open-ended, creative neural structures, you would have to have increasingly greater nurturing and care of your offspring and prolonged periods of total helplessness in your offspring for very good reasons. In the more primitive creatures, you can hardwire the whole response patterns of the world right into it. And you need very little nurturing. You need very little modeling or guidance. Those hardwired instinctual patterns of intelligence just can fire right in, and the creature is very quickly independent. But when you start adding great open-ended, unprogrammed possibilities in, as our great neural structures are, particularly the frontal lobes, as we'll talk about later, then you have to have a prolonged period in which the hardwiring stuff is replaced by software, so to speak, to use those terms, and the child is critically dependent upon modeling and prolonged period of helplessness, the in-arms period, and so on. And so we find that birth being a mammalian process, there are millions of years of genetically encoded intelligence in the woman that knows exactly what to do at birth. Nature leaves nothing out. Kennel and Klass were really quite right with this in spite of Diane Ayers when they said nature would provide this cascade of redundant processes. Not just going to leave it up to one or two things, but a redundant cascade of processes overlapping to make sure that this proper nurturing of this incredibly fragile but powerful system takes place. All mammals on Earth, when they get ready to deliver, and we operate out of that mammalian brain at delivery, seek out the quietest, safest, most private, dark spot. Any mammal on Earth, if you interrupt that safety, secure, dark hideaway, the signal that nature fires in is stop the birth process. Any interference of any sort, the birth process is designed to stop and wait for what? For the coast to clear, for the danger to remove. The mother might even change her birthing place. If that place is going to be not safe, we'll go somewhere else. And that's inherent within our whole system. At the first sign of interference, the birth process tends to stop and wait for the coast to clear. And of course, if the coast never clears, then you've got to do lots of other things intellectually to get the system going. We'll start, first of all, with Whittleston, University of Adelaide in Australia. I've been back there several times. And Whittleston years ago claimed that the mother's heartbeat was the most profound impact on the infant from the moment of conception on, that it literally, the system imprints to it on a cellular level, and later the entire neural system imprints to the mother's heartbeat. And we do know it has a profound effect on the infant's own heartbeat, even though they're at two totally different rates. That brings us up to the claim by Kennel and Klaus, which is certainly verified by research all over the world. I don't know why we don't recognize what's happened to the British National Childbirth Trust, the Swedish Pediatric Institute, the groups in Australia, and all who've been working on this issue for years, which prove this conclusively, that what the most critical issue immediately after birth is skin-to-skin contact between the mother and the infant. And we find that throughout human history, the mother has put the infant to the left breast immediately at birth with the umbilical cord intact. It's about exactly the right length that she can put the infant to the left breast at birth without disturbing the umbilical cord. 30% of the child's blood and oxygen supply remains in the placenta for about quite a long time after birth, and slowly will drain into the into the infant. Then action in the umbilical cord stops, and at that point, they don't need it anymore. Now, if we look at the connection with the heart, we get into some very interesting research. I've talked about the intelligence of the heart, and of course, everyone assumes that this is a metaphor. And it is a metaphor, but it's also a fact. Years ago, they discovered there was something unique about a heart cell. The heart cell contracts and expands. It's different from neuron, which operates on a kind of a vibratory basis. You can take a heart cell out of the heart and put it in the right kind of a fluid and keep it alive for a while. You can't do that with a neuron. If you disconnect a neuron from its connection with other neurons, generally it dies immediately. It has to be in its resonant field in order to operate. But the interesting thing about the heart cell disconnected from the heart was that quickly it lost its rhythmic pulsation and began to fibrillate, that is, flop all around out of rhythm and soon destroy itself and die. Put two heart cells on the slide, and they would both fibrillate in that fashion. The poor little creature can't stand to be cut off from its matrix, from its source, and neither can we, I will say. If we're cut off from our heart, we fibrillate. It just takes us a little longer to die. Now, the interesting thing about these two heart cells is if you bring them close enough together, at a certain point of proximity, spatial proximity, they don't have to touch, there can be a physical barrier between, but at a certain point of spatial proximity, the two heart cells somehow or other communicate with one another and immediately go back into the synchronous rhythm with each other which they experienced in the heart itself. Now, this has never been able, we've never been able to explain that. Now, I know why, but this has to be hypothetical. And that is the intelligence which functions through the heart, which is nonverbal, non-personal, it's transpersonal, universal, simply moving for well-being and not individual or anything like that, that this intelligence is non-localized. And the two cells simply have to come into a certain proximity, and then they are sharing the same non-localized field, and they go back into their synchrony with each other. And now if you take the hundreds of billions of cells that go together to make up a heart, all functioning in absolute synchrony with each other, you can see that if one communicates, one cell can communicate with another across a spatial or physical barrier, then obviously two hearts have some form of communication as well. Now, that has to be hypothetical, but there's a lot of evidence to back it up. Let's look at some of the other evidence about the heart. This was years ago. Then came along John and Beatrice Lacy, Fells Institute, Yellow Springs, Ohio, operating under a government grant, an NIMH grant, did years of research into the heart and drew the conclusions that there was a direct and intimate dialogue between the heart and the brain, between the heart and the limbic system of the brain. The limbic system being what? The emotional cognitive structures of the brain that handle all relationships. Remember that? We talked about that earlier. This mammalian brain handles all emotions, all relationships, and that has, the Lacy's claim, direct, unmediated connections with the heart thumping away down in our chest, and that the brain was always informing the heart of its current experience in the world, and the heart was always exhorting the brain to make an appropriate response to the world. Now, that was their claim years ago. Since then, they spoke of this as dialogue between the mind and the heart. Lots of other research on the heart has taken place. The discovery that between these cells of the heart, there are transmitters operating exactly as you have in the neurotransmitters of the brain, which means a great deal of communication is taking place on an individual level and on a collective level in this heart process. So with that as a preface, let's look at Whittleston's claim that the heart has a profound effect on the embryo, on the uterine, infant throughout the whole 9 months, and then at birth comes the greatest role of the heart. Researchers reading that the heart has an effect on the infant's brain and body went in back in the 60s and took recordings of a heartbeat and played them over loudspeakers in the nurseries of our hospitals where all of our newborns were isolated, of course, from their mothers. And it reduced crime by 40 to 50% right across the board. Now, a true scientific inquiry would have said why, and plumbed it to the depths to find why that profound effect on behavior would take place from an artificial, canned mother's heartbeat. Instead, those researchers rushed quickly to patent and market a rockabye teddy bear, which had within it a recorded heartbeat that could be played in the nursery at home to reduce crying by 40 to 50%, so the child's state of abandonment could be maintained and yet reduce the crying. The reason being, at birth, we do know that the biggest signal that nature's agenda calls for at birth is immediate contact with the mother's heart, as the infant has been in contact with it throughout the 9 months in its biggest single imprinting. And the mother immediately, in all preliterate societies, there's a little 30,000-year-old figurine which shows the newborn mother. She's still squatting, and she just brought her infant up to her breast. She's got a great big smile on her face, and she puts it to the left breast. Well, our research people said, well, that's because we're all right-handed, but we find left-handed mothers put their infants to the left breast as well. All fathers, when they pick up a new infant, will automatically keep it to the left hand, left breast, including left-handed fathers. Now, the reason being, and this has to be hypothetical, I have nothing other than my own intuitive knowledge of this to back me up, but if you bring that infant's heart into proximity, spatial, physical proximity of the mother's heart, something happens between these two levels of intelligence. There is an exchange between them, as there were between the two heart cells themselves. Remember the model imperative. No function is unfolded or awakened in us until we are in contact with an appropriate model of one who has developed that function. So the infant's heart picks up a tremendous signal from the mother's heart, and that signal is everything is great. We're back with our matrix in this new, wonderful kind of a world, but right back home where we belong. And we do know that that immediately shuts off the production of the adrenal steroids. There will be no shock in that infant. And instead, the infant is smiling and opening up to this new world to embrace it, absorb what it contains immediately. Now, Kennel and Klaus point out that it's the change in the mother's behavior that's critical here. And they said that in this contact with the infant, the mother's behavior pattern changes, and she is literally never the same again. Now, if you put that together with Paul MacLean's work in the brain, he claims, now this has to be just his hypothesis and mine, but we do know the cingulate gyrus area is connected with the frontal lobes and the whole thing of compassion and so on. At the same time, this is connected with the whole mammary process in mammals, so that the compulsion to breastfeed and all that will be controlled by this emotional cognitive system, its connection to the heart, and then in us, its connection with the great higher cortical structures and the compassion and the compulsion to nurture the infant is all locked into this procedure. Now, a woman in her heart-to-heart contact or skin-to-skin contact with her infant, you have a stimulus. This hypothesis reads that the cingulate gyrus area is activated by that stimulus, activated, establishes its connections with the great frontal lobes. The woman then is compulsively driven to protect and nurture that infant at all costs, even the cost of her own life. Paul MacLean was so dramatic about this as to state that herein lay species survival itself. And the only thing which threatens this then is threatening the survival of that species itself. Well, so the skin-skin contact immediately after birth is nature tries to assure it with this whole cascade of overlapping things. And given that, immediately the infant is opening up to embrace the world, and the mother is driven to protect and nurture the infant at all costs. She will compulsively breastfeed the child for a period of an average of 2 years. You say horrors, but nevertheless, I'm here to vouch for that. Every one of my grandchildren has been born this way, and my own child born this way. They were breastfed from 2 to 3 years, male and female. And it does make a difference. And the reason it makes a difference is because the human metabolic structure is designed to absorb only the smallest amounts of proteins and fats. This is work of Tinbergen, the Nobel laureate, and Blurton Jones and others in England. And they found that the metabolic system can't handle high levels of protein and fats. And the mother's milk is the poorest milk on earth. It's the thinnest, runniest, the poorest stuff. We can certainly do much better, much richer synthetically, but then the metabolic system of the child can't take care of it. So that the end result is the human child, according to this Nobel laureate and all of his staff over there, the human child, human infant, is designed to feed between 40 and 60 times a day, about every 20 minutes, to keep the metabolic system in shape. Now, you can feed them a highly synthetic food chock full of proteins and fats three or four times a day only, because it takes so long in between to digest it. It's so anti to the system. The system has such a hard time digesting it. That's what we did, of course, in 97% of all of our infants born since World War II. And there's a lot of problems that brings about, and I'll try to touch on those. So at any rate, we have this model imperative that the infant furnishes for the mother. The infant awakens and activates whole blocks of intelligences in the mother that are mammalian, that are inherited from our huge evolutionary past, and that mother will know exactly what to do for that infant at exactly the right time. It opens up a factor called intuition, which is the ability to perceive information not present to the sensory system, not present to this reptilian system, from a higher cortical structure, coming in higher up the evolutionary stream, as the medical doctor points out. We can come in higher up the evolutionary stream and receive information before it presents itself on a physical level. And the mother, who's bonded with her infant, can do precisely that. So it opens up intelligences, capacities, abilities, powers in her that she doesn't have. I know my mother, my last child, who was 35 when she had her first child, that's the high-risk age, and she had it at home. She was perfectly prepared for it. And I can tell you she underwent the most magnificent transformation. I mean, the woman I'd married and lived with her for all, 3 or 4 years just disappeared, and here was this other woman who knew exactly what to do, totally confident, totally powerful in herself. She was up moving around minutes after the child's birth, completely in charge of the situation. And we find that true when this proper awakening takes place in the mother's behavior patterns, and of course it does make a profound difference in the infants. They will reach those infants will reach object constancy anywhere from 6 to 8 months earlier than infants denied this kind of contact, and their whole pattern of development will be much smoother and advanced in the first 4 years of life. They tend to end kind of balance off afterwards, although there are deficiencies in infants denied this contact. So we have the most helpless of all infants on earth being the human being, and that's so that we can develop these software programs up here for moving into a world of creation. Now, by the way, you know, it's around the 6th month after life before the stomach begins producing, what is it? The word hydrochloric acid comes to mind. Is that correct? Is that what we use in digestion? Before the acids and chemicals necessary to digest proteins and all that kind of thing don't even appear until about 6 months. And that means that the child, of course, isn't designed to have anything other than mother's milk in that early period. Now, we get into the fact that this is the genetic inheritance. In pre-literate societies, this is still practiced. It makes our mothers here, and in fact, I've had them get very angry in workshops with this, but we do know the average length of time in pre-literate societies with these women totally in command of themselves without interference will deliver from the beginning to the end. It takes about 20 minutes on an average. And this has been well authenticated time and again. Now, the minute you start interfering with the process, it's going to take longer and longer. Why? The natural mammalian process is that the first sign of interference, we shut down the birth process and wait till the coast is clear. So let's look at what has happened. In the past century or so, we've had male surgeons who have suddenly begun to make inroads about a century ago, or more than that, on that which women have done throughout the whole of history. Since the dawn of time, women tended women at this most critical, crucial, and vulnerable part of their whole life. And we seem to muddle through as a species remarkably well against some overwhelming odds. And then male surgeons began to come in. As you can read Suzanne Arm's marvelous book, Immaculate Deception, about the male surgeons, first of all, use the same instruments. Of course, they have to use instruments. They have no instincts for it, so they use intellectual instruments. And they use the same instruments that they used in their operating on people and cadavers and all that, and the wholesale deaths from it was enormous. But at any rate, they took over from women, and in fact, following World War II, before World War II, only about 30% of women delivered in hospitals, and even before World War I, almost no women did, and then, not in our country, and then after World War II, 97% of all women delivered in hospitals because the male surgeons, the medical establishment, outlawed midwifery, as you know, in most places in the United States. So it became an illegal for women to tend women as they had down through the ages. I'm from the South. All of our black communities in the South delivered their infants always by midwives. It was a practice that had gone on for untold millennia. And you had this incredibly tight social cohesion in the Southern black communities. Most of our blacks lived in the South, and I had an awful lot of interaction with them as a child because I was brought up by black nannies and helpers and keepers. And I can tell you that the solidarity in those black communities was enormous. They took care of their own. There were no abandoned children. If something happened to parents, there were a dozen aunties and uncles and grannies and all. Whether they were kin or not made no difference to take over. And everyone loved every child. Every child was nurtured and handled and fondled and hugged by everybody. And we find in those early communities before World War II an enormous cohesiveness, those communities taking care of themselves. And then we outlawed that midwifery, and we broke up those birth patterns. A woman by the name of Beverly Gayen, I believe it is, in South Africa a number of years ago, wrote two books, in fact. She corresponded with me a bit about it, on the breaking up of the birth patterns among the Zulu and the Bantus and the rest of the black communities in South Africa that had started a few years ago. And she said, if you break up the birth patterns, you'll break up the whole social cohesive patterns holding those societies together. You break up the whole behavioral patterns of those people, and you're going to have chaos on your hands. Isn't that interesting? She made this statement a number of years ago, and of course they paid no attention to her. But now in our country, breaking up the system of midwifery by which our black communities had held themselves together against overwhelming odds. They held together against oppression that today you can't believe, and poverty, which was extreme, and yet kind of came out on top as a people, and now are at war with themselves on every hand in the majority of the black ghetto situations. And at the root of it, you will find the simple business of the interference of the mother's intelligence at the birth process itself. World War II was certainly the watershed for this. The other thing the males did was completely eliminate breastfeeding. Now, this was a male doctor engineered process to eliminate breastfeeding. 97% of our mothers breastfed up until about World War II, and after that, 3%. These are the 3%, by and large, with a few exceptions, who delivered their children at home. Only 3% of the children were delivered at home after World War II, and they're the ones that continue to breastfeed. Now, why breastfeeding is important, and that I can't go into right now, except that it is critically important. It keeps the child constantly in contact with the mother's face in the first few months. It takes about 6 to 8 months for the whole visual process to myelinate and stabilize, and the face cognition is the main thing. It's the one pattern the brain is born with, locked into its neural structures. Immediately at birth, when the child opens their eyes, they can recognize a face pattern, and they will smile in response to that face pattern from the first moment of birth on, which is nature's little trick she plays. Now, they can't recognize any other structural pattern, but they can recognize a face pattern. So we know that face pattern is built in. This was the work of Fance and a whole bunch of medical doctors back in the 60s. We know that pattern is built in as a neural, pre-structured neural system in the brain, simply awaiting the proper stimulus from the proper model out here, a human face, but the face must be given at a distance of 6 to 12 inches. The child cannot cognize that face pattern greater than 12 inches away, and 6 to 12 inches is exactly the distance when the mother puts the infant to the left breast, leaving that umbilical cord in T fact, they will spend 80% of their visual time locked in on that face pattern, 20% of their time looking out at other patterns, and then referring right back to the known pattern of the face. If they are given a face at 6 to 12 inches, if not, the visual pattern fails to materialize, and it will take anywhere from 9 to 12 months for it to compensate, 9 to 12 weeks for it to compensate and those visual patterns to finally start functioning. So what we find happening with the result of male interference, male intellectual interference with the natural intelligence of women, and finally taking over completely and outlawing women from having any part of it, we find these things a corresponding immediate rise of dysfunctions in our children. 50 years ago, there were zero cases recorded or even known or even anecdotal in American history of a suicide under age 14. Today, according to NIMH and their in-depth studies, suicide reaches all the way down to age 3. The American populace refuses to accept that idea. They attribute these early suicides always to accident. And you put these labels, keep out of the reach of children and all of that. No, these are deliberate suicides on the part of a 3-year-old in their state of extreme anxiety and despair. This has been pretty well established. Awfully hard to argue with statistics on this. And every 78 seconds, a child in America attempts suicide, right around the clock. Now, they don't all succeed. It's harder to do than they think. But this is a totally new anomaly in human history, and it follows an exact correspondence with the beginnings of the male intellectual interference of technological childbirth with the natural processes that the woman would take care of. We get into a whole raft of other things. I think it's interesting that there's a direct corresponding rise in the incidence of breast cancer with the elimination of breastfeeding. Only 3% of our mothers breastfed after World War II. And I simply ask you to look and you will see an immediate corresponding increase of breast cancer. Of course, the breast was no longer for feeding infants. It's for advertising purposes and male pleasures and so on and so forth. And breastfeeding becomes a cultural embarrassment. It really does, and in many places, illegal to do in public, and women were arrested for indecent exposure. And I invite you to go to some of the other foreign countries and watch the, in Switzerland, which is a very beautiful and benign country, the women casually on the lining the Lake Zurich there, everybody goes out to Lake Zurich for their lunch break, and they will sit there bare-breasted, and their little children playing all around and coming up and grabbing a little nip every few minutes, the little toddlers. No one thought anything about it, but that's what breasts are for. In our country, it became, of course, a cultural embarrassment, and women themselves are seriously embarrassed over the idea. So we have these things. Let's look at drugs very briefly. The introduction of drugs, of course, the infants and children that Freud was looking at, infants and their mothers were all drugged patients. This started, as you know, back in the 19th century and now is widespread. And we know that there is no drug made that can be administered to the mother that does not translate to the infant within an average of 45 seconds. The placental barrier is not effective against them. We do know that the drugged mother is a drugged infant, and both then the infant comes into the world drugged, unable to fully respond to a mother who can unable to fully respond to him. Neither can model for the other, and you have some problems right off the bat. We also know that the drugs cause various and sundry other kinds of problems in the infants themselves. The use of monitors, now I'm only going to skip through these in a hurry because these have been too well cataloged. Volumes and volumes have been written about all this. Of course, that doesn't have anything to do with the medical profession. They don't read them. But the use of monitors, the use of all these uterine monitor systems, we do know that the induction of these monitors and inserting these various things to check the infant's heartbeat and so on, that the use of the monitors themselves set up an artificial feedback system because it terrifies mothers. Remember again, the natural mammalian instinct is that any interference, the childbirth process designed to stop and wait until the coast is clear. Now, monitors create such an anxiety syndrome in the mothers that they skew the figures that they're monitoring themselves. That is, they tend to bring about the negative readings which you then read on the monitors, which then require more and more interference practices on the part of the medical people. This, again, was well established by the early 70s. I heard that all discussed in medical conference at the University of California back in the about 1974. The use of the monitors stopped, all of that helps to, of course, stop the birth process, which then means we induce other kinds of drugs to get the birth process going again. So we have the further use of drugs. Now that brings us to the fact of induced labor. We use drugs which induce the labor which we have artificially stopped by all of our interference patterns. Today, a majority, and at least this was the case back about 87, I really should keep up on this one, I might be sticking my neck out, but a majority of all births took place between 9 in the morning and 3 in the afternoon, the convenience hours of the doctors and the staff. And they simply do this by inducing a drug which fools the system and begins to bring about the labor process. So you miss the synchrony of the two systems that's brought about when the infant calls the shots and decides it's time to leave. So induced labor brings on a whole raft of problems, which we then respond to with more monitoring and a whole raft of other interference patterns. It all begins to become cyclical and escalating. Then we have the business of C-sectioning, which is a huge study that came out in back in the 70s, when C-sectioning was then rampant and growing by leaps and bounds, by ATW, an in-depth medical study by a group of medical doctors, which said that they could justify maybe 0.5% to 1% of all of the C-sectioning taking place in the United States. The rest of them were simply unjustifiable under any terms. Today, we have about 30% of our infants across the country C-sectioned and brought into the world that way. The mothers, of course, extremely incapacitated. It's a major, major operation. Would be considered a major operation in any circumstance. And the infant, of course, misses certain of the processes. Now, don't think any of these things can't be made up. We're the most resilient species on Earth. If all this happened to you and it happens to your children, don't despair, because there are almost none of these damages that can't be remediated with the proper time, energy, and so forth. And finally, there are lots of other things, but let's just look at the premature cutting of the umbilical cord. All of the old obstetrical textbooks before World War II said you never touch the umbilical cord so long as it's active. No obstetrician back in the old days going around from house to house would have ever cut the umbilical cord so long as it's active. During World War II, all that changed. Every single practice was changed during World War II, and they began the immediate cutting of the umbilical cord because no one had time to wait for the cord to shut down. Now, the minute you cut the umbilical cord, and 97% of our children have the umbilical cord cut the minute the child comes out of the womb into the world. The minute you cut that umbilical cord, the child goes into anoxia. 30% of its oxygen supply, blood supply, still in the placenta, they go into anoxia. Oxygen deprivation, which is the greatest single mammalian terror that the mammalian creature knows. And immediately the infants gasp for breath. They gasp for breath before the amniotic fluid is cleared from the trachea, from the nasal passages, and the nasal plug and all they call that has been removed. And that means what? They gag on their own amniotic fluid. And then immediately what happens? Well, they can't breathe. And we hear them strangling for breath. And so the classical picture is the infant is picked up at the heels and pounded on the back to clear, get the nasal plug out, and get them to breathing. Spank the baby, an archetypal image in the American mind. You see it in the movies, you see it on the plays, you see it on television. We accept that as the natural process of life. Spank the baby. Now, that is artificial induction of breathing. William F. Wendell, in his massive studies, published in the Scientific American, pointed out, in every case where artificial means, such as spanking the baby, have to be used to induce breathing, you are dealing with brain damage caused by oxygen deprivation. His estimate was 20 to 40% of all of the children having this happen to them would have brain damage to some extent, from minimum to severe. Don't think that this is something out of the dark ages. It's still standard practice. There have been some changes in hospital technological procedures as a result of a hue and cry and a lot of people hollering. as it should have been changed a long time ago. But the premature cutting of the umbilical cord is simply still practiced in the majority of cases. And you get this anoxia, and you get the child gasping for breath. At any rate, the premature cutting of the umbilical cord is a serious, serious thing. And I would just remind you again of the little water babies, and I've seen many of them, their beautiful development, and the fact that the umbilical cord is left intact and continues to produce oxygen for a period of 15 to 20 minutes. Nature thinks nothing of that. We then get into some other issues. The business of circumcision without anesthetics. Now, there are two big outfits in the United States now, one in Seattle, Washington, and one in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, I believe, who are made up of medical doctors, pediatricians, and a whole raft of outraged women who are suddenly looking at the automatic circumcision of all of our male infants, 97% of them, since World War II. World War II is, again, the watershed. The doctors have always said why they don't mind at all. They just give a little cry and then go right to sleep. So the question was raised, why do you have to use those restraining devices? They have to strap them down like mad because they resist fiercely. And so finally, recently, some of the doctors agreed to allowing research people to put electroencephalographs on the little infant and body sensors of various sorts. And they found that the infant doesn't just give a little cry and go right to sleep. They really scream bloody murder, most of them. Now, some of them respond differently and do not go to sleep, but they go into a state of shock, and the brain doesn't resume any of its normal biorhythms for a period of 2 to 3 days. Now, this is a lot different from the story being told. If you'll look at the work again of Drs. David Chamberlain, David Cheek, and Thomas Gurney on the highly conscious, extremely sensitive state of the newborn infant, certainly backed up by research in all other countries, particularly the Swedish pediatrics group that I know about, you'll find that that infant certainly registers the pain. Now, if we look at the most serious issue of all, I think, and that is the automatic practice of separating the infant from the mother at birth. Now, this is changing. More and more hospitals are beginning to put the infant with the mother. There are shorter and shorter periods of stay in the hospitals than there used to be. A lot of improvements are being made as a result of hospitals trying to protect their financial investments. But the situation is still far, far from good, and we are now dealing with the cumulative effect of 40-some years of serious outrage of the newborn infant and the mother. The separation of infant and mother that was practiced for all those years is the most serious of all the things. The minute the infant is out of the womb, the umbilical cord was cut. We know that they're very sensitive to bright lights, and the amphitheater, the operating theater, is very brilliantly lit, and they peel the infant's eyes back and then drop those chemicals in, as you know, to protect them against syphilis or gonorrhea or something like that. And the infant is then weighed and whisked off to a nursery. Now, this went on, and is still the case in an awful lot of hospitals in the United States. They follow the same practices. Now, let's look at what happens when you separate a child immediately at birth and you put them into the nurseries and so on. That child undergoes what's called psychological abandonment. They feel abandoned. They've lost their matrix. They've lost contact with every stimulus they've had for 9 months. They're given only this strange, barren, isolated world. And there is a retreat of the system, and it takes an average of 9 to 12 weeks for nature to compensate for this, and for nature to compensate for the lack of physical nurturing and stimulus. They're generally taken home, kept in cribs, kept in playpens and so on, always at a distance, never with close contact. They're bottle-fed. Breastfeeding disappeared in 97% of our mothers. They're bottle-fed. We were told back in the 50s by our obstetrician and pediatrician not only to bottle feed, they didn't like the idea of breastfeeding at all, but to use bottle holders so that there would be no personal contact. And so what do you have happening? You have happening a whole generation of young people appearing not only who have an underlying unnameable anxiety and fear of the world, but an enormous hostility against the world, and who feel alienated, cut off, not belonging, not being a part of. Why was I born with a strange face? I'm a stranger in a strange land. Why can't I be one of them out there? Each child feeling that. Why? Because literally these great bonding structures of the limbic structure, which hold us together as a species, have not been activated in that infant themselves. They themselves will be far less able to respond to their own infants, particularly if the same travesty is perpetrated on their children that was on them. So we find a cumulative effect, a kind of cyclic, again, escalating of the damages taking place. Now, where do these appear? These appear at all of the major bondings. I know Diane Ayers was so contemptuous of people who speak of further bondings beyond birth, but I'll promise you this, and I know this to be the case, and common sense, if you look at all of the data, will show it, that when we have that brain growth spurt at birth, age 1, age 4, age 7, and so forth, at each of these periods, new bonds are established. That's what they are. Bonds meaning simply new relational patterns. This is all biological. First of all with the mother, then with the family, and then with the whole world, the whole environment around the child, and then what, around age 7, the great social bonds. All societies throughout history have recognized the appearance of the social ego and our social inclinations around age 7. Our matrix begins to shift from the family toward the society as our main source of information and so on. Now, those bonds, and then, of course, the great pair bond between male and female in later adolescence on which all life rests. Maybe you can get it from a test tube, but it won't be the same. All life rests on that, and those pair bonds all depend on the establishment of these very basic biological neural structures in this body-brain system. Establishing the bond at birth is no guarantee of any other bond taking place. That whole thing can come to naught at any point. But without the establishment of the foundation, you pretty well assure that it will be doggone difficult to establish further bondings later on. So there again, the preliminary structures must be established in order for the higher structures to open. So for these very high bonds, the bonds of the spirit. Don't think there's not a bond of the spirit that should open up later in life. None of those stand much of a chance if that initial foundation is missing. And we systematically eliminated it from our children, cumulative effect over a 40 or 50 year period. Now, there is a raft of children being born to the world who are abandoned, and abandoned very quickly. And the plight of the unwanted child became a focus of international studies centering in Czechoslovakia recently. And a couple of years ago, they published their final reports on this. And they find that the child who is unwanted, who is abandoned at birth, or who senses that they are unwanted and abandoned at birth, the plight of that child is extreme. They are at risk on every level of human development. The intellectual system is severely at risk for development. Their immune system is at risk. Why? Because immunities are controlled by the emotional cognitive system and its interaction with the heart and the hormones there. We speak of America as the world of the touch-starved child. Ashley Montague wrote a marvelous book about it, and we speak of our touch starved children who have critically lacked the stimulus of their physical body system in the early years of life from isolation, separation. Now, I'm just trying to hammer this down to make sure that we recognize the full scope, and I've only touched on a very minor part of it, full scope of the critical need of the infant's interaction with either the mother or a permanent caretaker of some sort immediately at birth. From then on, this doesn't mean if the separation takes place that all is hopeless. Any of these processes can be compensated for and the deficiency overcome later on with sufficient work and intelligence. Unfortunately, those two are too often absent. Now, let's look finally then at what happened with hospitals. When all this stuff began to come out, and we're talking about major articles in Science, in Nature, in Scientific American, what did the hospital and medical people do? There's a smart chap a couple of millennia ago said, agree quickly with your adversary. Well, what they did is they just agreed quickly with their adversary. They've got to protect their $50 billion a year industry. So what did they do? They said, bonding? Oh, well, sure, we'll bond. And so it's sort of like the teacher saying, reading Montessori. Oh, I'll teach Montessori. See, we're going to come in and we're going to cram this process right down. Well, we'll set up bonding. We'll even give them a bonding room in certain cases. Maybe one hospital out of 1,000 would have it. But they all began to observe bonding. And so they began to let the fathers come in with their camcorders and going right through the same old routines there in that brilliantly lit place and all the drugs and all the rest of it. But here was father, and when they brought the little baby out and they clipped the umbilical cord and cleaned up, they put it on his mother's belly for a minute, and here were the camcorders recording it all. And then father would hold it, and then the mother hold it, and then whisk it, off it went. And everybody said, everything is great, now we've bonded. You see, now we've bonded. And now, we don't have to worry. Oh, so we've got daycare, but that's okay, we've all bonded. So the child's not going to be with her mama, she's going back to work, and she'll be with her for a couple of weeks, but then so on. It's okay, we've bonded. Now, this is the myth of bonding. That is truly a bogus issue. And I thank Diane Ayers in her book for pointing up the myth of that whole thing. But bonding, of course, it has to be established somewhere or should be established in that early period. And then it's simply the first step in a long, long developmental process. So denying that, we have a whole nation of children in trouble, and now we're dealing with about three generations that are in trouble. And the trouble is emotional, psychological, and a nation literally at war with itself. The betrayal of the newborn infant by his primary caretakers, by abandonment, is probably the most damaging single thing that can happen in life. Never again can that child enter into any close bond because they can't trust them. They can't open up and embrace their world because the world has betrayed them, it's violated them, it's damaged them, it's harmed them. They close up to a defense position. Even when they go ahead and develop high levels of intellect and brilliance and genius levels and so on, they're doing it on behalf of a self-system that feels betrayed, that doesn't trust its world, that doesn't open up to it, that draws from it, simply to bolster its own defense system. Sweden, the government of Sweden, has for a long time offered newborn mothers a full year's leave of absence with full pay to stay home with their infants. Why? Because it saves the state so much money later on. Did you know that recently Sweden passed a law that fathers too could get a year's leave of absence with pay to stay home because they were so critical to the whole process also? How can they afford to do that? How can they afford not to do that in this current day and time? Austria gives a mother a full year's pay and leave to nurture that infant. Australia gives any woman when she gets pregnant a stipend to live on that she might be able to stay with her infant. So we find that throughout the world this has been the growing awareness of the importance of this first year of life. In our country, our benevolent government could not even afford and wouldn't even tolerate the idea of allowing a woman 1 month's leave of absence, pay or no pay, 1 month's leave of absence to stay home with her infant. At the same time, that same government screamed about family values and so on and so forth. This is irony of an extreme. So we find that it cost an average of $37,000 to keep one prisoner in the cheapest jail in the United States. It costs an average of $37,000 per year. Our prison population is expanding at the most rapid rate of any epidemic increase in history. I've forgotten exactly the percentage of Americans who are in prison at any one time. but this is an issue I've been asked to address many, many times, is this rising prison population. Well, to say that it all stems from the birth process would be ridiculous. But to state that the birth process is probably the critical element in it and the prime cause of this is simply looking squarely at what's going on. My call is, my evangelistic call is that women rise up and take back from male surgeons the right toward their own reproductive process. And until they do, we'll be in increasing jeopardy. I would mention, by the way, that there are 6 times more fatalities in hospital births than in home births, regardless of the situation or the conditions in the homes. And that's true worldwide. And the hospitals, of course, I know all of their reasoning that they have for that. Nevertheless, there are 6 times more deaths in hospitals than in homes from the birth process. We stand 21st down among the technological nations for our fatalities at birth and the birth conditions. 20 other technological nations have better birth records than we have in the United States. And yet, it costs more to have a baby in the United States by huge folds than anywhere else in the world. So we have this great irony of the most expensive medical system in the world and the lowest possible care. Oh, the one final thing. Now, I will quit after this. But I must mention briefly about the plight of the unwed, early teenage black mother, which is an issue I have to steel myself to approach and get control of myself. And if I didn't get enough sleep the night before, I can't approach this issue because I get too emotional. But we find this rapid epidemic increase of early pregnancies, particularly in our black ghetto children. It's down to 9 at an epidemic rate now throughout the United States, and pregnancies at 9 and delivers at 9 and so on, and at 10 and 11 at epidemic increase. 60% of all black babies are being born to unwed, very early young mothers without any support at all from any direction. They have virtually no families, they have no support, they have no help, and they are given the lowest of all possible treatments in hospitals. Secondly, in a world that they have experienced total unloving, they have never been loved, they've never been nurtured, they've never been cared for, they look for something that they can love unconditionally. Thirdly, they look for something that will unconditionally love them in return. By the time they get out of hospital, they are at war with their infants. They abandon them at the greatest rate in the United States. They abuse them at the greatest rate in the United States. They kill them at the greatest rate in the United States of any other. What happens? Because of the treatment they receive. The study that came out in 1977 about the treatment of minority mothers in American hospitals, I got no further than about a chapter into it, and I burst into tears. I said, I'm through with the whole business. I'll never fool with it again. And I didn't for a number of years and got caught back up doing what I'm doing now.
I deal with the inner city teenage mothers that you're talking about. I'm a childbirth partner. So I go through labor and delivery with them, and it is a nightmare, and they still do that, pull on the cord, and it's basically child abuse. The sad thing is that most of the girls don't realize that they're being abused because they come from homes of abuse, so it's really sad to watch it. They don't have it in them to fight back because they're so used to being abused. It's so hard because you're just fighting such a big establishment, so I feel a lot of times hopeless in the hospital. A lot of times I just wait as long as I can, labor with them at St. Anne's, and then bring them to the hospital, and they're ready to push already, and I'm happy when we get a drug-free baby. But, you know, they just drug them out from that moment on, and it's like takes 3 hours to get the baby and for any kind of bonding. And what do you do? I mean, I feel so hopeless.
No, I don't think it's hopeless at all, and I think that the power of an aroused feminine group could just be astonishing if they really understood that it's 6 times more dangerous in the hospital than in homes, regardless of the situation. And this is statistical. This is backed up. And so on, if we could just get this across, but you're dealing with a massive generation by generation indoctrination, literally a brainwashing, to believe that childbirth is the most painful and dangerous experience they will ever have, and to operate outside the medical umbrella is tantamount to suicide. This is what they were actually, I've heard those very words used in the address of nurses to the hygiene classes and in high schools to the young women, that if they do anything other than keep themselves under the medical umbrella, it's tantamount to suicide, the most dangerous move they'll ever make in their life. And so you have this as a whole national acceptance built up again for many generations, and it's a pretty stuff, but it can be broken. And I think one of the ways it will be broken is if they realize the difference it makes in the infant and in the woman themselves.
Well, with this one baby, for example, even the staff nurses came just to look at this baby, because they had never, one of the student nurses came and she'd never seen a drug-free baby.
Yes.
This is amazing.
Yes, it's amazing. When that infant first comes out and makes eye contact and they're not drugged, this tremendous thing happens. Woo! It's a mystical experience. It's a religious experience. It turns your whole, it stops your world right at that spot. And what is happening in that contact, that visual contact with that infant? They speak of this great love affair being born at that point, which is the love affair of the universe, in which the emerging mother moves to protect the emerging child. And it's very powerful. So don't forget that what happens at that period is critical to everything that's going to happen the rest of our life. You women should take that power back into your own hands, get it out of the hands of the male surgeons while there's still time. The heart and the brain. Between the heart and the limbic system of the brain. The limbic system being what? The emotional cognitive structures of the brain that handle all relationship. Remember that? We talked about that earlier. This mammalian brain handles all emotions, all relationships, and that has, the Lacey's claim, direct, unmediated connections with the heart thumping away down in our chest. And that the brain was always informing the heart of its current experience in the world, and the heart was always exhorting the brain to make an appropriate response to the world. Now, that was their claim years ago. Since then, they spoke of this as dialogue between the mind and the heart. Lots of other research on the heart has taken place. The discovery that between these cells of the heart, there are transmitters operating exactly as you have in the neurotransmitters of the brain, which means a great deal of communication is taking place on an individual level and on the collective level in this heart process. So with that as a preface, let's look at Whittleston's claim that the heart has a profound effect on the embryo, on the uterine, infant throughout the whole 9 months, and then at birth comes the greatest role of the heart. Researchers reading that the heart has an effect on the infant's brain and body went in back in the 60s and took recordings of a heartbeat and played them over loudspeakers in the nurseries of our hospitals where all of our newborns were isolated, of course, from their mothers. And it reduced crying by 40 to 50% right across the board. Now, a true scientific on the infant's own heartbeat, even though they're at two totally different rates, that brings us up to the claim by Kennel and Klaus, which is certainly verified by research all over the world. I don't know why we don't recognize what's happened to the British National Childbirth Trust, the Swedish Pediatric Institute, the groups in Australia, and all who've been working on this issue for years, which proves this conclusively, that what the most critical issue immediately after birth is skin-to-skin contact between the mother and the infant. And we find that throughout human history, the mother has put the infant to the left breast immediately at birth with the umbilical cord intact. It's about exactly the right length that she can put the infant to the left breast at birth without disturbing the umbilical cord. 30% of the child's blood and oxygen supply remains in the placenta for about quite a long time after birth and slowly will drain into the infant. Then the action in the umbilical cord stops, and at that point, they don't need it anymore. Now, if we look at the connection with the heart, we get into some very interesting research. I've talked about the intelligence of the heart, and of course everyone assumes that this is a metaphor. And it is a metaphor, but it's also a fact. Years ago, they discovered there was something unique about a heart cell. The heart cell contracts and expands. It's different from neuron, which operates on a kind of a vibratory basis. You can take a heart cell out of the heart and put it in the right kind of a fluid and keep it alive for a while. You can't do that with a neuron. If you disconnect a neuron from its connection with other neurons, generally it dies immediately. It has to be in its resonant field in order to operate. But the interesting thing about the heart cell disconnected from the heart was that quickly it lost its rhythmic pulsation and began to fibrillate, that is, flop all around out of rhythm and soon destroy itself and die. Put two heart cells on the slide, and they would both... Every time we have intellectually interfered with a 15-billion-year process in preparation, that intellectual interference has been paid for at a bitter price. And we never learn. Intellect never learns that. And also, we make money off of it. So immediately, anything goes. At any rate, birth itself is, of course, a mammalian process. We know, and this is not just a joke, we know this is handled through the mammalian brain structure. And we know we've inherited that from millions of years of genetic encoding. And that mammalian, we call these mammary glands, those marvelous protuberances, mammary glands for good reason. They're mammalian. They're inherited from our mammalian ancestors. Paul MacLean did some of his most brilliant work on how, in order to build great new unprogrammed, open-ended, creative neural structures, you would have to have increasingly greater nurturing and care of your offspring and prolonged periods of total helplessness in your offspring for very good reasons. In the more primitive creatures, you can hardwire the whole response patterns of the world right into it. And you need very little nurturing. You need very little modeling or guidance. Those hardwired instinctual patterns of intelligence just can fire right in, and the creature is very quickly independent. But when you start adding great open-ended, unprogrammed possibilities in, as our great neural structures are, particularly the frontal lobes, as we'll talk about later, then you have to have a prolonged period in which the hardwiring stuff is replaced by software, so to speak, to use those terms, and the child is critically dependent upon modeling and prolonged period of helplessness, the in-arms period, and so on. And so we find that birth being a mammalian process, there are millions of years of genetically encoded intelligence in the woman that knows exactly what to do at birth. Nature leaves nothing out. Kennel and Klass were really quite right with this, in spite of Diane Ayers, when they said nature would provide this cascade of redundant processes. Not just going to leave it up to one or two things, but a redundant cascade of processes overlapping to make sure that this proper nurturing of this incredibly fragile but powerful system takes place. All mammals on Earth, when they get ready to deliver, and we operate out of that mammalian brain at delivery, seek out the quietest, safest, most private, dark spot. Any mammal on Earth, if you interrupt that safety, secure, dark hideaway, the signal that nature fires in is stop the birth process. Any interference of any sort, the birth process is designed to stop and wait for what? For the coast to clear, for the danger to remove. The mother might even change her birthing place. If that place is going to be not safe, we'll go somewhere else. And that's inherent within our whole system. At the first sign of interference, the birth process tends to stop and wait for the coast to clear. And of course, if the coast never clears, then you've got to do lots of other things intellectually to get the system going. We'll start, first of all, with Whittleston, University of Adelaide in Australia. I've been back there several times. And Whittleston years ago claimed that the mother's heartbeat was the most profound impact on the infant from the moment of conception on. that it literally, system imprints to it on a cellular level, and later the entire neural system imprints to the mother's heartbeat. And we do know it has a profound effect on fibrillate in that fashion. The poor little creature can't stand to be cut off from its matrix, from its source, and neither can we, I will say. If we're cut off from our heart, we fibrillate. It just takes us a little longer to die. Now, the interesting thing about these two heart cells is if you bring them close enough together, at a certain point of proximity, spatial proximity, they don't have to touch, there can be a physical barrier between, but at a certain point of spatial proximity, the two heart cells somehow or other communicate with one another and immediately go back into the synchronous rhythm with each other which they experienced in the heart itself. Now, this has never been able, we've never been able to explain that. Now, I know why, but this has to be hypothetical. And that is the intelligence which functions through the heart, which is nonverbal, nonpersonal, it's transpersonal, universal, simply moving for well-being and not individual or anything like that, that this intelligence is non-localized. And the two cells simply have to come into a certain proximity, and then they are sharing the same non-localized field, and they go back into their synchrony with each other. And now if you take the hundreds of billions of cells that go together to make up a heart, all functioning in absolute synchrony with each other, you can see that if one communicates, one cell can communicate with another across a spatial or physical barrier, then obviously two hearts have some form of communication as well. Now that has to be hypothetical, but there's a lot of evidence to back it up. Now, let's look at some of the other evidence about the heart. This was years ago. Then came along John and Beatrice Lacey, Fells Institute, Yellow Springs, Ohio, operating under a government grant, an NIMH grant, did years of research into the heart and drew the conclusions that there was a direct and intimate dialogue between the